Picture this. It is the summer of 1944. Over the brown water of the Adriatic, a formation of B-17 flying fortresses is pushing northeast toward oil refineries in Romania. The crews have been to this part of the sky before, they know what waits. Flak so thick you could almost taxi on it, and German fighters coming hard out of the sun, diving through the formation picking the stragglers, but something is different today. The escort is already there, sliding into position on the wings before the bombers even clear the coast, and these P-51 Mustangs have their tails painted red. A tail gunner in one of those B-17s leans forward on his interphone and says, "Those are the red tails, we're gonna be all right." He was right. I'm Tail Dragger on Radio Hangar, and today we're talking about the Tuskegee Airmen. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSold.com. Pull up a chair, because this one goes deep. The story of the Tuskegee Airmen doesn't begin with airplanes. It begins with a lie. An official, documented, government-stamped lie. The Army Air Corps, in the years before the war, had commissioned studies concluding that Black Americans were mentally and physically unsuited for aviation. The studies were fraudulent. The conclusions were predetermined. The military wanted a reason to keep Black pilots out of the sky, and somebody obliged by writing it down on official letterhead and filing it in a folder somewhere in Washington. But pressure has a way of building. Civil rights organizations, Black newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier and the Chicago Defender, college students at campuses across the country, they kept pushing. The argument was simple and impossible to answer, honestly. If this country was going to ask Black men to fight and die for it, then Black men deserve to fly for it. In 1941, the Army relented. Sort of. They didn't integrate the Air Corps. They created a separate program, an experiment they called it. They would train Black pilots at Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama on the grounds of the historically Black Tuskegee University, and they would see what happened. The chief flight instructor was a man named Charles Alfred Anderson, though everybody called him Chief. Chief Anderson had logged thousands of hours before the program started. He had taught himself to fly, largely because flight schools wouldn't take him. He had earned every rating he held against the grain of a system designed to stop him. And when Eleanor Roosevelt visited Tuskegee in 1941, she climbed into the front seat of Chief Anderson's Piper Cub, and he took her up and flew her over the red clay hills of Alabama. And she came back down grinning, and she told the press that Black men clearly could fly. That visit mattered. The program had a patron now. What the Army didn't say out loud, though it was understood in certain quarters, was that many of the men running the experiment expected it to fail. They expected to gather their data, write their report, and confirm what they had already decided was true. What they got instead was the 332nd Fighter Group. The first class of 13 pilots graduated from Tuskegee in March of 1942. They were assigned to the 99th Pursuit Squadron. They trained on the Bell P-39 Aerocobra, got their combat orders, and eventually shipped to North Africa. Their early record in the air was uneven. A lot of fighter squadrons struggled early in deployment. The learning curve in combat is brutal, regardless of who you are, and the 99th was no exception. They were green, they were dropped into a theater they hadn't specifically trained for, and they took their lumps. The critics and the War Department pounced on that. Memos started circulating recommending the experiment be terminated. "The performance doesn't justify the expense," the documents said. "The program should be folded." Now here's where it gets interesting. The man who stopped those memos wasn't a senator or a general with stars on his collar. He was a colonel and a pilot. His name was Benjamin O. Davis, Jr.
Davis was the son of Benjamin O. Davis, Sr., who in 1940 was the first Black general officer in the history of the United States Army. The son went to West Point. And at West Point in the 1930s, the other cadets subjected him to what they called the silencing. Not a single one of them spoke to him socially for 4 years. They ate in formation, required to by regulation, but nobody voluntarily exchanged a word with him. They refused to room with him for 4 years. Benjamin Davis existed in an institution designed to build camaraderie and unit cohesion, and he was systematically excluded from all of it. He graduated anyway, 35th in his class of 278, when the War Department's memos started circulating, Davis sat down and wrote a rebuttal. He documented point by point the conditions under which the 99th had been deployed: insufficient preparation time, inadequate coordination with existing theater units, denied the same period of unit cohesion that white squadrons developed before being committed to combat. His argument was methodical, it was precise, it was tactically sound, and it worked. The effort to disband the program stopped cold. By early 1944, the program had grown enough that four squadrons coming out of Tuskegee were consolidated into the 332nd Fighter Group. Davis took command. They transitioned from the Curtiss P-40 Warhawk to eventually the airplane everybody wanted in the European theater, the North American P-51 Mustang D model, and they painted the tails red. There are several stories about exactly why the red tails. Some accounts credit a decision about unit identification. Some say it evolved from earlier paint schemes. What matters less than the origin is what it came to mean. In those bomber formations pushing into Germany and Romania and Hungary and Austria, when the crews spotted red-tailed P-51s sliding into escort position on their wings, something changed. Shoulders came down, breathing steadied. The Red Tails had built a reputation, and that reputation traveled the circuit of every briefing room in the 15th Air Force. The missions they flew were the hardest on the board. Long-range bomber escort into heavily defended targets, the oil refineries at Bleschhammer in occupied Poland, the synthetic fuel plants at Brux in the Sudetenland, rail yards in Munich, the Drava River bridges in Yugoslavia. They flew tactical support and ground attack. They strafed airfields and rail yards and marshalling areas. They destroyed aircraft on the ground and fought them in the air. But the number that mattered most to the men in those bombers was one number. Over more than 200 escort missions, the 332nd Fighter Group never lost a heavy bomber to enemy fighters. Now, historians have examined that record carefully over the decades, and I want to be honest with you about what the scrutiny shows. There are edge cases. There are bombers that went down on missions where the 332nd was present, and in some of those cases the cause is uncertain. The claim, as it is sometimes stated in its most absolute form, has been qualified by careful research. But the core of it holds. The 332nd had an exceptionally low rate of bombers lost under their protection, significantly below the norm for escort groups in that theater, and the bomber crews knew it and requested them by name. There was a reason for that record, and it was not mystical. It was discipline. In the fighter pilot culture of World War II, a lot of escort groups would break from their bombers to chase German fighters. You have to understand the psychology of that. Aerial kill confirmations were how careers were built. Aces got their names in the newspapers back home. If you had a German fighter dead to rights and the energy to run him down, chasing him felt like exactly the right call. Davis made it doctrine that you do not chase. You do not leave the bombers. Your job is those bombers, and you stay with them until they're safe. And anything else is a failure, regardless of what your gun camera film shows. He built that standard into the culture of the group, and he enforced it without exception. That discipline is the record. The 332nd flew over 15,000 individual sorties before the war ended. They produced 96 officer pilots killed in action and 32 taken prisoner. They earned the Distinguished Unit Citation twice. Individual pilots accumulated more than 800 medals, including 150 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 14 Bronze Stars, and the Silver Star. One of those Distinguished Flying Crosses went to a pilot named Charles McGee. McGee would go on to fly 136 combat missions in Korea in F-86 Sabres, then 172 missions in Vietnam in F-4 Phantoms, for a career total of more than 400 combat missions across three wars. He was still flying general aviation at the age of 93. He passed away in January of 2022. He was 102 years old, 400 combat missions. A man who flew P-51s over Romanian oil refineries in 1944, Sabres over MiG Alley in the early 50s, and Phantoms over Vietnam in the late 60s, and kept flying for the love of it until nearly the end. Now I want to talk about something that doesn't get enough attention in the Tuskegee story, what happened when they came home. These men who had fought across the Mediterranean, who had held the line above bomber formations over the most defended airspace in Europe, who had earned medal after medal in service to their country, came home and found that their country hadn't moved. In April of 1945, a group of Tuskegee pilots returning from training at Freeman Field in Seymour, Indiana, attempted to enter the officers' club on base. They were commissioned officers of the United States Army Air Forces. They had every right to walk through that door. They were arrested. More than 100 officers were detained. Several were court-martialed. The charges were eventually dropped or reversed, but it took decades for the records to be fully cleared. Think about that. Men who flew P-51s in combat, who wore military wings on their uniforms, who had protected the bombers that were helping win the war in Europe, were arrested for walking into the wrong building on their own base. Integration of the American military didn't come until 1948, when President Truman signed Executive Order 9981. Davis, who had fought the bureaucracy from inside for years, became one of the first black generals in the newly independent Air Force. He eventually retired as a four-star general in 1998, 56 years after those first 13 pilots graduated at Tuskegee. He passed away in 2002. The Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site sits at Moton Field in Tuskegee, Alabama, the original training airfield where the program began. The hangar is still there. The ramp is still there. If you have not made the trip, put it on your list. Walk where these men soloed. Stand on that Alabama ground and think about what it actually took to become a military aviator in this country, when the country itself was actively working against you at every level. I've had the privilege of talking with a handful of Tuskegee veterans over the years. At air shows, at fly-ins, standing next to airplanes in the morning before the crowds arrived, every single one of them, when you asked why they kept flying after everything the military put them through, gave you some version of the same answer. The sky didn't care what color you were up there, you were just a pilot. Yeah, much of what I've drawn on today comes from historians at the Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site, Charles Francis's research in his book On the Airmen, and the oral history projects that captured these stories before too many of the men who lived them were gone. More on aviation history that deserves your attention at radiohangar.com. Taildragger. See you next time.